Hey there, and welcome to the Dynamics Hot Dish Podcast, serving up stories and knowledge on Dynamics 365 and the Power Platform. This is what's hot in Dynamics. You're now joining Merlin Schweiger, Liz McGlennon, and Ashley Steiner.
Welcome, everyone. We are going to be covering allyship today with Allie Lawler. She's a Salesforce consultant at iBailey. So we're really excited to have you here, Allie, to share, you know, the work you've done and kind of your perspective on what it means to be an ally and an allyship. So I'll hand it over to you to share more about yourself and introduce yourself.
Yeah. I always make the joke that there's really nobody better to talk about being an ally than an Allie. So it's really a topic that I love to talk about a lot. As you said, I'm a Salesforce consultant at a tax and audit firm that also does tech consulting. And I've also just done a lot of speaking and advocating for DEI, so diversity, equity, inclusion, especially in corporate spaces, because that's typically where, you know, both I participate in the most and also where I see that those areas kind of lacking a little bit. So I've done a lot of advocacy work there. And then I also do a lot of just general volunteering and community participation. I love to go out and be busy and do things. So I'm a person who does just a lot of things, but is especially passionate about these topics and allyship.
Yeah, I know you're really involved in the Salesforce community, which we can relate to because we were on that side of things, but for Microsoft. And we met at a Salesforce user group a few years back, and you did a great presentation on allyship. So I'm excited to have you here today.
Yeah, I'm excited to be here.
So our first question is just to have you share your opinion on why DEI is important in tech and why the tech industry should be thinking and talking about this.
I think, you know, I like to think about it in terms of the year 2000 versus the year 2020, because when we think about the general population of industries, the population of the tech industry versus manufacturing and a lot of more physical or manual labor industries in 1990 and 2000, huge, huge population on manufacturing, jobs that require human interaction. I say the word manual, but I don't mean like physical labor, but they require a person to do a lot of those jobs. In 2020, that's no longer the case. We now have more jobs on the tech side because a lot of jobs that used to be manual can now be automated. And while the population has shifted, the focus on making sure that all of that population can participate equitably hasn't grown, shifted, changed much at all. So tech is an industry that is so far ahead in so many ways, but behind in this really, really important way. I've been working in tech for 5-6 years now. And, you know, thinking about just the experience that I've had, I'm a cis white woman, straight. I have a lot of advantages in my life. And just with the, you know, couple of marginalized identities that I hold, I'm neurodivergent, I'm plus size. I've experienced a ton of inequity in tech. And I can't even imagine what the experience would be for someone who holds more marginalized identity than I do. So it's really important that people in tech start thinking about, as technology continues to grow, continues to be more important, and continues to take a larger share of the workforce, how can we ensure that workforces are going to be included and want to stay in tech?
Would you want to share more about, you mentioned marginalized identities, and kind of explain that to us or our listeners?
Yeah. Yeah. So marginalized identity, it's the term that I use in place of minorities, because often people who are of marginalized identity are not actually the minority, but it refers to someone who is a part of a community that has been marginalized in some specific way. So some examples would be folks who are of a non-white race. So Black folks, Indigenous folks, Asian folks, that would be a racial marginalized community. If you are a member of the LGBTQ plus community, that means that you hold that marginalized identity. If you are non-binary or trans, marginalized identity. So I like to think of it also on the flip side of that is what kind of privilege can you hold? So like I said, I am a straight white cis woman. So I hold a lot of privilege, meaning that I don't hold a lot of marginalized identity. So when we think about allyship, allyship is the lifelong commitment and journey to building relationships with marginalized communities that are based in trust and commitment, just like any other relationship in your life. And so being able to identify what does it mean for someone to be marginalized, for someone to have experienced oppression or marginalization in their life, and how can I form a relationship with them? That's really what allyship is all about.
That was going to be my question, is how do you define allyship? Like this is one of the first times I'm hearing it in that term. Right. And so I'm glad that you used, I was going to ask that just right out from the beginning, like maybe we should define that for people.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And allyship really, super important thing to call out is that allyship is going to look very different depending on who you are, you know, being an ally for. Allyship in general is something that we can say, hey, you need to build a relationship with people. You need to show up. You need to be consistent. You need to be trustworthy. But the actual actions that you participate in can look different depending on whoever you're looking to form that relationship with. So in general, we can act like an ally, and there's a couple things that are pretty straightforward, pretty consistent across the board, but it is important to think about who am I looking to be an ally for and make sure that actions are tailored to that specific community, whatever their needs are, and to listen to them and listen to what they want from your allyship.
So you're saying it's not as easy as a one size fits all approach.
Definitely not. So as much as I wish it were, because it would make it a lot easier for a lot of people to participate in allyship a lot more, it's something that takes time, takes practice. It's something that I personally have been working on for a long time now, and I'm not perfect by any means. It's kind of impossible to be perfect at, and that's okay. It's kind of, you know, something that we've talked about before, imposter syndrome, when you feel like you have to be exactly right. You feel like you have to achieve this thing. It's about giving yourself the grace and saying it's impossible to be a perfect ally. The best that I can do is act like an ally each and every day.
That makes like sense. That.
So my first question is going to be, you said there are a couple consistent things. Mm-hmm. If I wish to become a better ally, where do I start?
Yeah. Starting is absolutely going to be the cliche. It starts with you. think about, even not in terms of allyship, just thinking about building any relationship. We hear it a lot in movies and books, et cetera. In order to be able to form a relationship with someone, you have to love yourself first, kind of thing. You have to, similar thing with allyship, you have to focus on yourself first. I like to say that it begins with personal internal work and then can grow to external work, to community work, et cetera. And so the very first thing that I think is really important for anyone to do is to first take on the long-term work that is required to understand what your personal biases are. You know, the word unconscious bias tossed around a lot. So understanding your personal biases and beginning to learn more. Being open to learning is something that is going to be a constant, no matter what. And I say be open to learning because it's another thing that you don't just, oh, I've read all the books and I'm done. I've learned everything there is to learn about the Black community, about the queer community. That's just not true. There is no point at which you're done. So just practicing being open to learning, practicing being open to taking in new information. And for those unconscious biases, I personally started by taking the Project Implicit Bias Test. It's if you like Google Project Implicit, it takes you through a quiz. You can look at all these different types of biases. It'll have you go through them. You'll do a little reaction test and it will let you know what unconscious biases you might have. And it's important to know that none of these biases are like our fault. It's not like, hey, I tried to have this bias against a specific group of people. That's not true at all. But really, this is just arming us with tools to help address that bias. It's not our fault, but it is our problem that we get to solve. So understanding what bias you might have and starting to just intake new information. It could be every day, try to follow someone on Instagram who doesn't look like you. Every day, try and share one resource that you've learned from in your life, whether it's a book, a podcast, you know, a piece of music, anything like that. Small steps to just try and normalize the non-white and non-privileged experience, like straight, white, cis, wealthy experiences have been normalized in society.
So I'm going to ask something that might come across controversial, right? And it's not meant to, but I've always been a big believer in, like, you can't solve, like, me personally, I can't solve all the world's problems, right? Like, I have to pick things that I'm passionate about and really try to make a difference there. Something I'm passionate about is increasing the diversity in tech. And so that's something that Liz Merlin and I are actively working on. There's other things that bother me about the world, but you don't have, I mean, I don't have the capacity. So is it okay or normal that, like, okay, this is the one bias that I know I have, or this is the one area where I know I can be a better ally or want to be a better ally, but you don't necessarily work on the other ones. Is that in your mind good, bad? I mean, I want to make sure, like, it's hard to be an ally to everybody the same at the same level. But if you're like, wow, I really know that this is a marginalized community, that's where I want to make my impact. I mean, what is your opinion on that?
Yeah, it's definitely really, really hard. And that's where that imposter syndrome comes back. You'll see there are examples of people who are doing incredible work and acting in allyship seemingly to everybody at once. And you're like, I'm not a superhero. I don't have that many hours in the day to do all these things. And what's important to note is that a lot of the internal work, especially with tackling bias, it doesn't actually take that much time. And over time, it will become a lot easier. So as an example, I have a couple of biases. It's, you know, if people want to share them, that's totally fine. It's also a very personal thing. But if I have a bias, I would say like 4 years ago is when I started learning about my biases and starting to recognize them. 4 years ago, I was putting a lot more effort than I am today into trying to catch when my brain was affected by that bias. If I was approaching someone that I have a bias against on the street and I crossed to the other side without thinking about it, it was stopping myself in that moment to say, oh, wait, did I just cross the street? Was it for an actual reason or was it because of my bias? And that was like an internal conversation that happened multiple times a day. You know, I don't know how fast other people think, but I, you know, say that's a minute each time, whatever it is. And over time, it becomes a lot easier to call yourself out a little bit. So now, 4 years later, there will be times where that bias affects my thinking, causes me to react in a certain way in my thoughts, and immediately I'll be like, oh, nope, that was a little bit racist. That was a little bit homophobic. Let's shift our thinking. And it happens almost instantaneously for me now. So the first part of the question, which is I can't do it all. Internally, you can, and it's a muscle that you have to train, just like any other muscle. It's understanding when that unconscious and implicit bias starts to affect your thinking and how you react to things. It takes a little bit of work, and you can focus on one, you know, one and then the next and then the next, et cetera, and it will become easier. It absolutely does. But the second piece, which is more of the outward allyship, you know, the actions that we're taking, it's absolutely okay to acknowledge and know that you can't possibly do everything at once. If I could, if I had Jeff Bezos money, man, I'd be giving that out mutually to everybody at once. It'd be so exciting, but we don't all have the same resources, and it's doing something with our resources. That's the important thing. Systemic oppression in our society is a truck rolling downhill. None of us pushed it. None of us put it in neutral. None of us placed it at the top of this hill, but it's rolling downhill. And if we don't do something to try and slow it down, it's going to keep going. And so it doesn't mean that everybody needs to go plant themselves in front of the truck. That's not going to work because somebody is going to get hurt. Somebody is not going to make it out of there, but it's about all of us working together to do little things, such as, you know, if all of us build up a brick wall in front of it, brick by brick, each of us contributing a little piece that we can, that's when we'll start to see a larger change that will be more effective. So it's not about ever shaming yourself for not doing enough, but it's critically taking that step back to say, is what I'm doing right now effective? Or is it, you know, is it making a difference? And is there something I could do more that would be super easy to do and I'm just choosing not to? Or am I realistically at a healthy limit for what I can do right now? Because I do think it's important to reevaluate you know, I would say in 2020, in June 2020, and a lot of things were going on in Minneapolis, I was 150% in the community. I literally like stopped working. I told my work, I'm like, hey, I'm just consider me gone for a little bit. And I was 150% like shoving everything that I had toward community and things like that. And at some point I had to say, hold on, is this the healthy amount that I'm giving? Because if I give 150%, then there is negative 50. And that means that tomorrow I can't give anybody anything. So making sure that you are consistently reevaluating, seeing how much can I give. And if you reach a point where you're like, you know what, I have a lot of extra time right now, or a lot of extra resources of some variety, I could probably do something with those that wouldn't be too exerting. That's totally okay. It's whatever we can realistically give, and making sure that we are critically evaluating ourselves to make sure that we're not just not doing something because it's convenient.
Yeah. Okay. Go ahead.
No, go ahead.
I was just going to say, like, I thank you for the answer, right? I mean, I bounced on that question a little bit because I didn't want it to make it seem like you don't want to help, but sometimes I think that that's a barrier for people. It's like, mm-hmm. Okay, I'm really passionate about this, but I'm not making or doing anything over here. So I appreciate the answer. Thank you.
Yeah. And I was just going to say that I think it's a good point that you shouldn't feel bad. Like if you feel like you should be doing more, but you like, you need to take care of yourself too. Like you're 150% in example, like that's not sustainable. And so it's okay to reevaluate or to be doing different things or different amounts of things at different times in your life, depending on where you're at personally.
Yeah. I mean, one thing that I'm really passionate about is mutual aid. I believe that people with access in the community should help lift others up. I'm very privileged in my job to be able to do that to a degree. And it's definitely very difficult to say, okay, yes, maybe I have $50 in my bank account. I could, like, there's money in there right now, I could give it away. But what I struggle with is remembering, oh yeah, I have bills coming up. That's why that $50 is still in there, because you do feel a little bit guilty for not giving everything that you can. But I realize, like, even still sometimes daily, I'm like, oh, what I think is giving everything that I can is different from actually giving what I'm able to while still keeping a roof over my family's head. Back in June 2020, I skipped work. I was like living in this church that we were operating out of for like a week. And I'm like, this is not good. I'm not showering. I'm in the same underwear for 4 days. Like, this is not sustainable at all. And that's an extreme example, but if we give so much that we then are not in a position to help anybody anymore, that's not great. And at the same time, like I said, we need to make sure that our taking care of ourselves doesn't become too indulgent, for lack of a better term. Like, absolutely treat yourself, be proud of what you do, be proud of what you can build for yourself. But I want to make sure that I never get to the point where I'm getting stingy with my dollars again, that kind of thing, and stingy with any resources, just because that can build up over time. You can be like, give less and less over time and be like, I'm still giving a little bit. Well, still make sure that you're critically reevaluating and reassessing and being like, what do I have that I'm able to offer to my community, to my environment right now?
So I feel like when we talk about resources and giving back, like people think about time and money. Mm-hmm. Are there other resources that you think of that, you know, people can contribute?
Absolutely.
In case they're lacking in either or both of those.
Yes. The most important one is absolutely social capital. Thinking about a lot of people that I know, I grew up in Prior Lake, Minnesota, in an area that is relatively wealthy compared to, even other areas I've lived in my life. And it's largely like a white community. And so I have a lot of opportunity to influence conversations. There are a lot of people in my life who don't have the same exposure that I do to, you know, DEI work. And so when I'm in those social situations, when I hear things like, as an example, way back in 2015, 2016, there was a protest that shut down I-35, the major highway in Minneapolis. And I remembered somebody, I don't even remember who at this point, but I remember somebody saying like, oh, that sucks. It's so inconvenient because I need to get to work. And I was like, is it convenient that people are having to protest? Because, you know, is it convenient that people are being killed unfairly? Is it convenient that people are having their wages stolen from them by corporations? Like, I have an opportunity to insert myself into those conversations, and I'm never going to shame someone, make them feel badly, because they might just not have been exposed to DEI topics. So social capital is a huge thing. Encouraging those conversations is a resource, and distributing that information is a resource. And then I would also say that the sharing of any stuff, for lack of a better term, created by marginalized identities is huge. So thinking about, you know, books, movies, music, art, social media accounts, blogs, podcasts, anything that can be produced by someone, sharing those kinds of things is made just stupid easy by social media. I mean, on Instagram, you click a button, share to your story, you're done. That kind of thing, it's incredibly easy to do. It's relatively free. Obviously, you have to have a phone with internet access, which is not available to everyone. But in the scope of things, it's relatively cheaper. And things like that, that's a resource too. Making sure that you can help lift up others, even if you don't have money or a significant amount of time to give yourself.
I like those examples. Mm-hmm. I think that's, I don't know, back to Liz's point, like, I feel like that's often the, like, well, if I'm going to give something, it has to be time or money. And if I don't have that much money or I don't have that much time, then I have nothing left to give. And so I'll just wait until I'm richer or unemployed or whatever. So that's, I don't know, that's good advice.
Yeah. Each of us has an impact on the people around us. And so, you know, one thing that I hear pretty frequently is, like, I have a friend who's a mom of like four kids, and she's like, I don't have time. I don't have money. I don't have attention. And I'm like, but you do have the impact on your children. That's the major resource that you have. And so even something as your impact on one other person on your life, to make sure that they are armed with knowledge and mental resources. So how to think through these kinds of things, that's huge. Especially if they're a younger person, because the more that we can help show younger generations become us, and then we become older, you know, whatever. It's all a giant funnel. So even if you can impact a person in your life, that's a resource. That's still doing something, you know, in a very small community of two people. So
I mean, that raises like a good, I'm kind of always embarrassed to tell this story. I think that like, I wasn't necessarily embarrassed back then. But so anyways, let me just tell you the story, and then you can see why I'm saying it like this. So when I moved to a big corporation, right, the first large corporation that I worked for, they had a D&I council. Back then it was D&I. And the concept was so lost to me. I was like, I don't get it. Like, why do we have to teach people to treat people the same? Like, isn't that just normal? Like, don't people just like you hire, like you don't look at somebody's skin color or the gender, like when you're hiring, or you don't treat them different. Like, I was so confused by the concept of needing something like that. And then realizing that there's other people that don't think like that, that it confounded me. Like, I have to be honest. And so now I'm kind of embarrassed because, you know, I am involved in women in tech groups, and, you know, we've talked about TechFluent on here. So clearly it's not obvious to everybody, but that was one of those moments where I was like, I also grew up on an Indian reservation, Allie. You don't know that about me. Liz and Merlin do. So I feel like I have a very different like upbringing than I would say most people. So I guess I don't know if that had a huge impact on it, but it was wild to me that you had to have, or you should have, a D&I type thing in your workplace to really confront these issues. Cause for me, I was like, well, I don't get it. Like, isn't that just how people are? So I don't know if people run into that, or if you run into that where people are like, well, isn't that just normal? Like, doesn't everybody look at it? But they don't. I mean, clearly.
No. And I think it's definitely a challenge to show people that there's a problem. Even companies that are doing really, really well in, you know, in the greater scheme of things compared to a lot of other companies, there are still a lot of problems, you know, because ultimately when we say problems, it is a problem if any employee experiences, you know, any form of marginalization in the workplace, whether that's overt discrimination, which is, you know, the companies who are doing really poorly, a lot of overt discrimination, or if it's microaggressions, which are super small, but are happening more frequently at the companies who are, quote unquote, doing really well in DEI. So it's a problem if any employee feels that way. And generally speaking, I don't like to be like super general and talking about DEI, but it's kind of have to. But generally speaking, when you've got a company that is 90% white, 70% white dudes, and you don't have a lot of marginalized employees, then a lot of people are like, there's no problems because I don't know people. I don't know anybody who's got a problem with things. And those folks who are experiencing any kind of discrimination or marginalization aren't really going to feel super comfortable speaking up about it. So there are so many people who are just in the mindset of there's no problem here. And then anyone who is, I hate the term woke. I hate it so much, but it's like, I need a better term for it.
Is there a different term for that?
Anyone who is aware of...
I was like, maybe we can coin one here, Allie. We should create, because I agree, like the term woke, it's so overused. So
like anybody who's aware of, you know, the current culture of diversity, equity, and inclusion, even then, I still consistently see people saying, I think things are pretty good. And it's like, are they though? Because what's important is that you have to ask employees who are of marginalized identity. And I'm consistently seeing companies doing like a company survey and they're like 90% of the people here are white and 92% of people say that everything's great here. And I'm like, hold on though. What's the Venn diagram look like? Because if that of that 92%, you've got all the white folks saying it's okay, but then 80% of your non-white folks are like, this is terrible. There's your problem. So the numbers aren't adding up. And so it's tough because again, I never want, and this is me personally, I never want somebody to feel badly for ignorance, for just not being aware of what's going on, because my personal role as an ally, something that I have an opportunity to do, is to teach people and help them learn, help people, you know, see the light. So I don't want people to feel bad about it, but I do want to hold people accountable to it.
Well, and to your point, if you shame them or make them feel bad, they're less likely to hear you out, right? To hear your opinion, you know, to hear your thoughts and this is why things are. So I agree with you on that one. It's delicately bringing it up in a way that it'll make an impact, but still making sure that it really hits home.
Right. And it's really tough because there's not necessarily like, as a communications person, that's like what I majored in college. In comms, I am always thinking about my messaging. And generally speaking, a lot of this discrimination, microaggressions, et cetera, does not deserve a delicate approach. It deserves this is what you said was really bad and you need to be held accountable for that thing. And I will also note that as a person of privilege, this is just how I approach things with that delicate touch. But if someone is, you know, if a Black person has a microaggression committed against them, especially on a regular basis, as so many folks do in the workplace, they don't owe someone a delicate touch. They don't owe someone niceness after being discriminated against, after having that marginalization thrown at them. So while we don't owe someone that, hey, let's talk about this, that gentle lead into a conversation, that is how I as an ally personally tend to approach it, just because that's, you know, I am coming from a place of privilege and I want to help invite others into the conversation as much as I can.
I think that makes sense too. I've been having some conversations with some friends of mine. It's made me realize a few things about sort of other, in my case, white dude perceptions of like diversity and equity sort of issues at large in society. And the thing that I sort of came to realize is I remember kind of my trigger point where I realized like, oh, there is actually something wrong here. Like that the point when I realized that I was the fish that was in water, like I saw the water for the first time. And I feel like for me, it was like this little fact. Like I learned this little fact about, from a statistical perspective, easier for a white felon to get a job than a Black man with no record. And I was like mind blown, like what, that can't possibly be true. And I feel like that was my little trigger moment. And so what I've been trying to do in this conversation with some of my other friends, at least a couple of whom are very well intentioned and understand that there's a problem, but don't quite fully see, like, I don't know, they haven't come all the way around to like, yes, I need to like participate in this, or understanding where they shouldn't be participating in this because they're not coming at it in the community that it applies to. I'm like trying to figure out like what is the thing that will speak to them, because I, at least based on my own experience, I feel like I just have to find the thing. Like there's a fact somewhere or a comparison or a situation that if I can just talk with that one thing about them, then they'll be like, ah, and then they'll see it.
Yeah. That trigger point is going to be different for everybody. It's a very similar thing where I was, for the first time, I was like, whoa, this is not great. This is bad. Mm-hmm. This is really bad. What I would definitely encourage to anyone in a similar situation is do your very best to share experiences of people who are marginalized, to share that information. A big topic in DEI in general is there are a lot of white folks. You know, I'm white. There's a lot of white folks talking about what's best to do. And the thing is that in any relationship between marginalized community and privileged community, the privileged community does not get to decide what to do and does not get to tell what the facts of the situation are. The marginalized community gets to say, this is what we need from allies, and gets to define, this is what's happening to us. It's not my job as a person of privilege to take away someone else's story, much like as a plus size person, if when someone who is conventionally thin tries to tell me about problems with the plus size fashion industry, I get heated. I get mad. I lose my stuff. And so, you know, it's important that when we're trying to help people, help show people, hey, this is what's going on, try and do that by sharing stories, blogs, social media pages. Do that by sharing marginalized voices and sharing marginalized experience so that it's coming directly from people who are affected by it. That overall is both going to be most impactful, but it also makes sure that we're not trying to speak for them.
So before we wrap up and ask kind of like our favorite special question, Liz and Marlon, do you guys have any other questions, thoughts, or Ali, anything you want to share?
Well, I feel like we haven't talked about personal allyship yet.
For personal allyship, there's so many things that can be said. you know, first I want to make sure that I know exactly what we're looking for. Are you talking about personal allyship, like what are steps that I can take personally to make sure that I am becoming a better ally every day? Or are you talking more about how I can be an ally even to myself with my marginalized identities? Like what are you?
I was thinking more the latter, but Marilyn and Ashley, feel free to chime in too.
No, I'm intrigued to hear the latter as well.
So, you know, when we think about how can we be an ally, especially as we might hold marginalized identities, whenever I've talked about this, I always, you know, I'm a good example of myself. I do hold marginalized identity. I am a plus size person and I experience, you know, oppression against plus size bodies every single day. I'm also neurodivergent, and there are absolutely a lot of things, especially in the corporate world, that are not made for me, that are detrimental to the way my brain operates. But despite me holding those marginalized experiences, I hold so much privilege in so many other areas. And one thing that I will hear a lot is, especially from a lot of white folks, is when I say, you have white privilege, I have white privilege, we have white privilege, they'll say, I'm not privileged. I grew up really poor. I had to work for what I have, et cetera. And there's this idea of intersectionality. And intersectionality is that multiple things can be true at the same time without canceling each other out in this example. So just because you hold white privilege does not mean that you also hold economic privilege or educational privilege. And so you can still be an economically disadvantaged person. You can belong to an economically disadvantaged community, but you can still hold white privilege at the same time. And those two things don't cancel each other out. They're both true parts of your identity. And so it's really critical for us to internalize that. And it's a really tough thing to think about, because each and every one of us, we've also gone through, I'm thinking of like in middle school, when we went through those special presentation days with keynote speakers where they talked to us about overcoming challenges and struggles and how everybody has something that they're dealing with. We don't want to take away and invalidate anyone's experiences that they've had in life that have made them feel disadvantage, that have made them feel down, anything like that. But we really have to work with each other to make sure that we are holding those two concepts together. I have experienced marginalization. I have experienced oppression. And at the same time, I am a member of an oppressive fill in the blank. I am a member of an oppressive race. I am a member of an oppressive sexual orientation. And so that's a really challenging thing. It's especially tough to folks who are brand new to these conversations. And that's where a lot of like personal grace is required. So when I think about how I want to be an ally for others versus being an ally to myself, it looks really different. When I'm trying to act an allyship in like in Minneapolis, the Black community here, I work to be an ally, to act like an ally wherever I can. And I'm really passionate about the community locally and here in Minneapolis, because obviously that's where I'm from. That's where I grew up. And it, my allyship there looks very, very differently than when I am advocating for a community that I'm a member of. When, I, like I said, when talking about, as an example, discrimination against plus size bodies in medicine, in doctors, I get extremely heated. I'm ready to come out fighting. And so it's just, it's a really tough thing to be able to hold two things at once and to know that there are different ways to approach things in different situations and to give yourself the grace of for not knowing what to do sometimes, because there's a lot of people who are really afraid to take any action, who are afraid to voice any thoughts because they're afraid of saying or doing the wrong thing. And knowing that none of us know exactly what the right thing is to do at any time is really important. There are obvious things that it's like, that was a bad idea to say, that was a bad tweet, you should delete that tweet. And so just knowing that you might mess up, it's important to own that, to take accountability for your own actions sometimes, but just giving yourself a lot of grace is what I personally have to do a lot.
So who wants to ask the signature question as we close up here? Liz, do you want to, or
one of you should?
Merlin, you don't ask it very often. Go ahead.
I don't get to ask it very often. All right. I'll ask it since you're local. I don't have to explain it.
No.
So what is your favorite hot dish?
Obviously tater tot, without any hesitation. They're, you know, it's definitely the, I feel like it is very much the star of the hot dish family. Most people who are not aware of hot dishes, they still have heard of tater tot hot dish. And it's also fascinating to introduce it to people who've never had it before, because they like look at this plate before them and they're like, there's corn in here. And I can see meat, but I'm not sure what it is. And it's really tough to describe to them. And you're like, I promise you that ground beef and mushroom soup and corn, I promise it's really good.
Is that visually appealing though on the plate?
I will say that it's a really good reflection of Minnesota, because man, we are like 90%. Well, I shouldn't say, we're 60% winter and the other 40% is exclusively fall and spring, which is usually like kind of gray, kind of bland colors, a little pop of yellow here and there, but that's pretty, it's like a good representation of us. I feel like it's a really good, it's my favorite. So
awesome. We had somebody on a few weeks ago who said that like having COVID kind of changed his taste buds for beef. So I wonder, so I will say that I did get some recipes submitted to me for a vegetarian tater tot hot dish that I will be sharing out as well. So I'm glad that you brought it up, Alex. It reminded me.
Ground turkey, ground chicken. Ground chicken is super cheap for those of you who are also Aldi shoppers like I am. It's like $2 a pound for ground chicken.
Yeah, I like to use that when I make like lettuce wraps and things like that. Mm-hmm. It's awesome. Yeah, cool. Well, thank you so much, Ali, for joining us. It was very educational and really appreciate you taking the time.
Absolutely. Thanks for having me. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Dynamics Hot Dish Podcast. For additional content and previous episodes, check out our website at dynamicshotdish.com. Follow us on Twitter at Dynamics Hot Dish, and subscribe to our podcast for notifications. Thanks. See you next time.